I'm Mark Gagan, and you're listening to the Voice of Insurance podcast, produced in association with Advantage Go, enabling enterprise-scale underwriting through a single pane of glass. Greg Hendrick is a dream guest. He's smart, incredibly knowledgeable and experienced, but also really easy and fun to talk to. He's also still only in the fifth year of building out a major insurer, reinsurer, and capital markets partner completely from scratch. For Greg and Vantage Risk, time moves a lot faster and experience is accelerated and compressed compared to the rest of us. There's a huge amount to talk about, and that's why I was delighted to be able to spend so much time talking to him again. Here we catch up on how Greg's strategy has evolved against plan and get into great detail about the state of the market all the way across the insurance value chain. But I'm glad we also spend a lot of time looking at how technology is shaping the future of underwriting and completely reorganising the way that we all work and interact with our colleagues day to day. After all, not many people get the chance to use all their experience to design a whole new business from scratch following a contemporary blueprint with no legacy issues to deal with. Greg sounds like he's really enjoying this opportunity, and I think you'll enjoy it too. Enjoy the podcast. Greg, welcome back to the Voice of Insurance.
Mark, thanks so much for having me back. I feel almost like a regular visitor on your podcast.
Well, I'm really honored that you are a regular visitor, because when you're building a company from scratch, time goes at a different speed from everyone else. Your years are different. I don't want to say dog years. You're a different animal, let's say. The time moves at a different pace for a startup company that is maturing, particularly now you're getting to this kind of quickening phase, I presume, where you've built a lot of the infrastructure and you can finally start to reap the benefits of what you've built. And so that's my first question is, obviously, I listened back to what we were talking about last time you were on the show, and you were talking about it takes a bit of a while. Obviously, we have that lag with insurance companies. It takes a while to get up on the plane, as you described it. And so you up on the plane now.
Yeah, getting to scale. I mean, that's really when you're trying to run a business of taking small numbers of risk, but in large amounts of risk. Yeah, you need to get to scale. And I'd say we're there in reinsurance. It doesn't mean we're going to stop growing. It doesn't mean we're going to stop expanding. But in the reinsurance business, we're at scale in the classes that we've chosen to underwrite. On the insurance side, it's kind of a mix. People have joined us later. Businesses have started later. Some of the businesses like political risk that were here from the get-go, they're up on plane and at scale. Others are still getting going. And some are dealing with headwinds, public D&O and cyber in particular, where we still think the pricing is adequate. But boy, if everybody keeps up with where they're headed, it won't be. And so we're taking a kind of a cautious approach as we move into it. But we feel like we're getting to scale finally over more of the business than not.
Well, I suppose we can talk about public D&O, because we're definitely going to have a conversation about casualty, if you'll let me. Again, we can throw that in later, because that is a bit of a head scratcher, to say the least. So, but where are you in terms of your headcount and volume?
Yeah, so we're now north of 300 people. Actually, we've just gone over 310 colleagues, split between Bermuda and the U.S. In terms of last year, we finished with about $350 million of reinsurance gross written premium and $725 million of insurance gross written premium. And then the third leg of our stool is Advantage, which is the ILS manager. And that had $1 billion under management last year and $1.5 billion in 24. So we're pleased with where we ended up 3 years out of scratch to create a brand new company and achieve some meaningful volume. So we're pleased with where we've gotten to and very humbled by the support we've gotten from our brokers and our clients over the past 3 years.
Let's talk about Advantage, because I've read a lot about it, but I've only ever spoken about it directly with you. What is the long-term plan? Is it to be a sort of hybrid? So you've still got reinsurance net exposure there. And obviously you've got the ILS manager. Or would you rather be 100% an ILS manager, or is it a bit of both?
There's definitely Advantage as part of Vantage overall. If you go back to the beginning, I was very fortunate. Chris McEwen wanted to join forces at the very beginning. And when we sat down, this is going back to 2020 in the middle of the pandemic. And at the time we sat together was in the summertime. And it was the first time we had really sat with other people that weren't our immediate family members. But when we sat down and sketched out kind of some of the things we wanted to do, we both were in complete alignment on, we believe ILS is here to stay. We believe there will be ups and downs in terms of the attractiveness of it, but that there is a large group of people that believe in this and want to see not only more of it, but also different classes of business. And so from the very beginning, we set up Advantage. Now, it was tiny, as you would expect, for 21 and 22. And then when we got to the end of 22, we felt that as Vantage on our balance sheet, we couldn't really drive the change in the property cat market that was coming. That was going to happen from the really big cat players. So we felt a better proposition for us was to upsize Advantage and write the vast majority, almost all of our property cat exposure there, as opposed to on our balance sheet. We see that continuing, and we see it as we described it at the beginning. AdVantage is part of Vantage. It's separately managed. It has its own goals and metrics, and it needs to take care of both brokers, clients, and its investors. But we get a lot of good halo effect between Vantage Reinsurance in particular and AdVantage. And we're very happy with the way that is and intend to continue that way as we continue to grow both insurance, reinsurance, and AdVantage.
Well, certainly ILS has really come through for the reinsurance market, hasn't it? I mean, in terms of Advantage, you were one of the only players actually bringing new capital. This was through Advantage, wasn't it? It was a significant amount of new capital as well into the market. Certainly most of the, say, traditional balance sheet players wouldn't seem that they were bringing extra capital to the party. It seems a validation that at Advantage, you were able to grow those funds under management and get investors to buy in.
We were fortunate to have good support from the investors. We are not doing what I would call kind of a sidecar approach at all. Almost all the property cat treaty risk, except for some contracts that were multiple year expired, on Vantage's balance sheet. And then we raised this money and wrote more risk, more capacity, but of a different kind. And the investors in this case wanted very high risk, high return exposure. They have plenty of other assets deployed in lots of other areas. And they wanted this one to diversify them in their other areas, but they wanted it to be high risk, high reward. Over time, we are working to add different strategies within CAT and to add different classes of business. Most of it on this idea of partnership capital. We're not setting up a CAT bond fund. We're not setting up a fund management structure. It's very much around sophisticated investors that want this asset class because it diversifies what they do overall.
Presumably, if someone's looking for slightly higher risk at the moment, you would have been very much in demand because most of the new capital has been wanting to play in very high new top layers, very long way from the risk. And presumably your capital, if it was that kind of appetite, must have been really, really in demand.
Yeah, Chris, Brian, Josh, all became very, very popular people. Sometimes it gets written up as being retro. Retro is a component of it, but there's a lot of what I would call direct catastrophe business as well. And so it's a very good mix of business, blended business, and yeah, very popular people. And for good reason, we have capacity that is there, unlike what we could have done on the balance sheet, where we would have been assuming smaller shares of large programs. We can say, here's a $25 or $50 million line. And as long as it pays our rate and it's got our terms, we're happy to go along. And if not, that's fine as well. We'll find other places to deploy it.
When you say, yes, it's not a sidecar, so you don't have to fully align your own balance sheet. You don't have to take sort of a share, skin in the game. Necessarily.
No, we align with them. We definitely align with them, but it's not a traditional model at all.
And you were saying about potential for other classes. Are you close to getting other classes into this model?
Well, when you're doing groundbreaking work, if dare I call anything we do in the reinsurance and insurance world groundbreaking, when you're doing groundbreaking, we're trying to do new. I always never going to say, are we close? We are working hard on something around long tail and other classes of business. You've seen in the marketplace the recent activity around cyber.
Yeah.
I would underwrite that on both the insurance and the reinsurance side of the operation. So we definitely have some things we're working on. I'm going to hesitate to say from close because these things have long gestation periods.
I suppose until they happen, they just haven't happened. And therefore, it doesn't really matter how close you are. If it never happens, it never happens.
I'm not a superstitious person, generally speaking, but when it comes to this stuff, there's a little bit of knocking on wood, I guess, for those, because there's no visuals. I'm knocking on my head as I speak. I believe we'll get there, but they just do take time. And for good reason, because CAT has been around for so long, whether you hate the models or like the models or, you know, you're somewhere in between, you understand kind of the general parameters of what's going on. When you're talking to people about cyber or casualty or even marine and aviation, it's just another level of education around how do the losses happen? It's kind of what we call a medium tail line where events happen suddenly and early on, but they may not fully manifest themselves financially for 2 or 3 or 4 years. So trying to get that kind of conversation going, money needs to stay longer than kind of the classic catastrophe kind of 12 to 18 month period. So it's a number of those conversations that take time.
And it could be almost any class, you could say.
Potentially, yes. Why would I say otherwise?
So you're building the business. Last time we spoke, I was asking you about what the perfect balance would be for the business that you're building. And you said certainly of that proportion between insurance and reinsurance, you'd say it would ideally be about 70% insurance and 30% reinsurance. Seems like you're about there. And also, given the dynamics in the market, has that calculus changed at all? I mean, obviously, reinsurance is much better than it was, for example. So, you know, would you say, oh, well, the market's this good, why wouldn't I go 50-50?
Yeah, so very good memory. I did say that and was saying that early on to convey the idea of more insurance than reinsurance over time. Why would I say that? I'm of the reinsurance market. It's where I spent the first 15 years of my XL journey, starting at MidOcean through a whole bunch of different name changes. And I think it's a great business, and we will write it, and we will write meaningful amounts of it, and we'll continue to grow in it. And what will dictate how much we write will be the profit opportunity, not whether the math says I'm at 32% or I'm at 28%. And so it can flex pretty widely. You know, I don't think we'll let it go over 50% is my guess, but in that 20 to 40 range, I could see reinsurance flexing if the profit opportunities are there. So why do we say more insurance? Well, the reality at the moment is that the equity markets and investors in general value insurance franchises more than reinsurance franchises. There's a much, much lower barrier to entry to reinsurance than there is insurance. And there's a higher degree of stickiness because you're controlling your own destiny on the insurance side, as opposed to in reinsurance, you're relying on the insurance company to seat you business. So that's the reality at the moment. And so we'll continue on that trend of being more insurance than reinsurance. But we're not slaves to the split when we can make, Dinos would say this quite often, you know, if you can make money underwriting, you should underwrite it, Greg. So we are following through on that wise advice from our non-exec chair.
Sorry to interrupt in mid-flow, but this is just a reminder that you could be advertising right here, right now, and getting your message directly into the ear of key decision makers in the insurance industry. And you'll be doing it while they're absolutely in listening mode. The podcast is the medium of the future, and so is audio advertising. Contact me on mark@thevoiceofinsurance.com, and I'll do everything I can to get you started.
Well, so it's a good market. Hopefully you can make money underwriting, you can make fees underwriting on behalf of other people, and you can make money underwriting in insurance or in reinsurance at the moment. This is what you're saying. It's a good market, I presume.
It is a good market, and we're nimble enough at 310 people. We can take advantage of being fairly agnostic as to whether we take something in insurance form or reinsurance form. Obviously, on the reinsurance side, you have to be cognizant of you've got clients, their information is proprietary. We can't use any of that on the insurance side of the house. But if we're looking at an opportunity coming in, we can say, all right, that might be better to write in insurance because we've got the capability for it. We've got the paper for it. Let's go that direction. Or it may be, for instance, something coming from overseas where we don't have the insurance capability. So let's tackle that on the reinsurance side. So it's great to have that and not have a lot of established kind of, this is reinsurance and don't go over there. This is insurance and stay over there. And we're not wired like that. We're pretty nimble, pretty lean, partly because we're so small, partly because we're so new, and partly because I'm convinced we've grown up now as a company in this age of post-COVID, and it's virtual and people like to communicate and get together and stay connected.
Obviously, on the insurance side, you were talking earlier about you've got varying degrees of scale and some are really sort of up on the plane and others obviously still getting there because it takes time. Are there still classes that you're not in that you still definitely would like to be in?
Yes, we're going to be adding new business. We're building our property insurance offering, which we didn't build in the first 2 years, mainly because we had a meaningful amount of exposure in the balance sheet already, and prudent risk management would say you can't go long property cat on both sides. So we were long reinsurance and short insurance. Now we're building the property business up there. And obviously the property market in North America is red hot. Maybe it's a little cooler than red hot, but it's still very, very strong and a lot of opportunity for us there.
Well, certainly when I look at, we're just coming through the full year results season of all the public companies and yeah, well, property has been performing for absolutely everybody.
And I think it's got opportunity on both sides of insurance and reinsurance. You know, you got to go one way or another in this marketplace. So that's one area we're adding. We're adding capabilities next to. So we've done excess casualty. Now we've added primary casualty, non-admitted. So we continue to see those areas that we think we want to be in for probably obvious competitive reasons. I'm not going to go through the whole laundry list for you. I would say the other way around, which is unlikely to see us be a personal lines insurance company, likely to see us in Europe, Asia, Latin America, not because they're not wonderful places. They are. We're just not of a size or scale to be able to tackle those things.
I suppose it's a perennial question I probably asked you every other time that you've been on. You're still ruling out international expansion at this stage.
Yes. The last piece of the puzzle for Vantage will likely be something with London, but that's not a 24 and might not even be a 25 event, but certainly can't help but see the great turnaround effort from all the practitioners over there and the modernization and the work seemingly, to me anyways, to bearing fruit that, you know, that's an area where we would be looking because we've got classes of business like political risk that would benefit from being in London and having access to the other parts of the world.
Yes, fingers crossed. We're in a real kind of vintage moment at the moment in London, which is great. And it's a hell of a turnaround from only 3 or 4 years ago when we, you know, it was a very difficult times. But there you are. This is the way things happen in insurance. You've got to keep believing, I think.
It is a cyclical business. And so when you identify what's causing the damaging part of the cycle, you get after it, you fix it, and it creates the next part of the cycle. And we'd love to see the amplitude of that high and low start to come together a little more, so we don't have to get to 110 combined to get back to 84 and stay somewhere nicely in the 90s. But so far, that's evaded the industry.
Well, sort of on cyclicality, certainly, is it cyclical or is it secular? We would have to talk about that. But there's been a huge move and continued wave of underwriting talent becoming MGAs rather than going to work for balance sheet companies or people starting their own MGAs. And I've certainly seen when I'm scanning the press, I see Vantage's name mentioned as a paper provider to lots of, you know, interesting MGAs doing all sorts of wonderful and exciting things. I just didn't remember that being part of your original strategy. Has it always been there, or is it just a really good way? Obviously, I know we talked a lot about talent, and obviously you can't do any of these things without getting the right talent. Is it because that's the best way of accessing the talent these days? Because if the talent has decided that it wants to be an MGA, then you can back the talent by backing their MGA.
Look, generally, we want to be underwriting the business ourselves. And that was the core premise as we came out of it. But we did from the beginning understand there were going to be times where we either wanted to get into a specific class of business that we weren't going to be able to attract the expertise and that we would need to partner with somebody to access that. Or an MGA had a true advantage, either in distribution or in analytic pricing power, right? So they're either able to get to customers that we couldn't get to. And that was the first one we did. We did one with a company called Tower Hill in Florida that I've known for decades. And we write their small commercial E&S business with the paper for them. We partnered up together. I could never go out and reproduce what Tower Hill has because right next to this business, they have $1 billion almost of homeowners business and know every agent in the state of Florida. And so it's a real easy piece. I oversimplify, it's never easy. But it's easy to see how you can go and say, okay, Mr. Agent, I've got a capacity for small E&S property if you've got that in your portfolio and pull that. We were never going to reproduce that. And so that was one of, boy, there's a great distribution model there. The other example would be, we don't have paper for London, but we had some folks that we knew well for non-US D&O, and we supported them through a front company called Rising Edge, and they've been writing non-US D&O and absorbing all the risk on that. And it's a person that knows the market really well in Yul Brightman and super knowledgeable, super talented. And we wanted to back that expertise because I don't have anywhere to hire that person to let them write directly on behalf of it. We looked at 200 plus last year. We added two new. So this is not a business that we're looking to compete with the 20 or so carriers that are already out there doing this.
Yeah. So no, we're not going to note you down as another addition to the burgeoning list of hybrid carriers or fronting carriers, whatever you want to call them.
There's a bunch of folks focused very, very sharply on that marketplace. Our belief is that from time to time, we will have things that we want to do that we just can't get the access ourselves directly, and we'll go through MGAs.
Do it when it really makes sense and there's no other way of doing it or no better way of doing it.
And when there's a true alignment of interest, you know, when you have the ability to really look everybody in the eyes and say, yeah, you're going to be compensated to do this, you're going to be compensated to do that. And if things go really well, we're going to share those good times. So that's a very important part to us. And bluntly, why sometimes we don't get deals across the line is we're very, very anchored on making sure there's a good alignment of interest.
And also there's a really long list of MGAs, very successful MGAs that have built a fantastic relationship with their paper providers. And then they end up joining them anyway in probably year 8, 9, or 10 or something like that. That does happen, doesn't it?
It does. Yep, it definitely does. Multiples of the moment for MGAs and make it harder for carriers.
Yeah.
However, there's a sense that perhaps those are coming in a bit over time as debt gets harder to access and capital gets harder to access.
Yeah, things are all cyclical, and that includes valuations of carriers and obviously intermediaries of all different shapes and forms. But I wanted your view on, obviously, we're old enough to know about the cyclicality in the E&S market and that its relationship with the admitted lines market. We seem to be in a moment where, obviously, we've had a huge amount of business flow to the E&S market, perhaps now for probably in the fourth or fifth year. Do you think there's any sign of that waning? And we all know the market will turn at some point. If and when it turns, will that business flow back the other way? Or is a lot of this actually secular, i.e. a permanent change in the way that business is being done?
Yeah, I would bifurcate it between kind of personal small commercial and kind of middle market large commercial. To me, you still should see that ebb and flow where business will come back and forth. In the middle market large commercial side, I think it's much more secular because you have two sophisticated parties dealing with each other. There's no naivete on either side. That doesn't need a regulator to say, hey, this is the only way you can sell this form or these are the way. It really is custom-made situation for the non-admitted E&S marketplace to make sure that you know you're customizing the coverage to what your client's specific risks and needs are. And so I think that's why you've seen in the middle market, large commercial, why you've seen more and more migrate to non-admitted. I think that will continue. Consumers, and in the form of either buying their own personal insurance or for their small businesses, I think you're still going to see the ebb and flow between admitted and non-admitted market right now, driven by, not exclusively, but predominantly catastrophe-driven exposures where it's all coming towards the E&S market.
As the industry, as underwriters, we're always saying, oh, the great thing about the E&S market is, of course, it's so much more responsive. I can respond, whereas now I'm in the admitted market, I've got to file on my rates and policy forms, et cetera. But of course, I suppose that cuts both ways. It cuts for the client, doesn't it, as well, that E&S can be far more responsive more quickly in the favor of the client as well, so that they can get answers quicker, they can get things that they want quicker without, of course, we don't have to all start filing new policy forms for new coverages you're giving.
The E&S market is not immune to pricing competition as well, as we've seen in the in past years. So right now, there's a perception of direction of travel of E&S equals more expensive. I think I would say it differently, that E&S equals matching the premium with the risk that you're taking on in a much better way for these complex risks. So yeah, that's the key point here, is these are complex risks that we're talking about, where that, to me, the direction of travel is headed towards the E&S market.
And do you think that secularity, the other part driving that secularity, is that, of course, the risks themselves are just getting more complex?
Oh, yes. I mean, and anytime you want to do something new and cover new risks, you're always going to start out in the non-admitted market, right? Just think about if you've watched some of the latest things that have come on the industry, you know, intellectual property, some of the other classes that we've seen emerge, those are all on a non-admitted basis because you just have to have that flexibility.
Perhaps the biggest debate within all parts of the insurance value chain at the moment is about casualty in general and then US casualty in particular. Where are you standing on this? Which side of the debate are you on? And obviously, being a legacy-free carrier, certainly don't have that poor experience that some people have had to deal with, and you're not having to bolster reserves from prior years. Does that flavor your judgment in certain ways? You didn't have that recency bias of, you know, any of those unpleasant conversations with your actuaries that you might have had?
The 15 to 19 or 15 to 20 accident years in the US for long tail lines of business have developed poorly for almost, well, I would imagine everybody. I haven't done all the yellow perils over the last, I'd have to start in 19 through to today. There's just been deteriorating development. And that's what caused the opportunity for Vantage to start. That's great. I don't have to worry about that. But then you have to say, okay, well, what is the price going forward in 23, 24, 25 and beyond? And there, you know, I don't think anybody has an advantage because of the existing carriers are dealing with such step change in their assumptions around rate and form and limits. We started fresh, but we don't have an anchoring point to come off of. And so for us, the constant exploration is we believe that the market is adequately paid. We believe that the market on the casualty side is keeping up with trend through the rate increases, at least that we see on what we're underwriting. But you're watching it super closely to make sure that that statement is true. And you just need some time to let that season out. So I think there in the discussion about 22, 23, 24, there's not a huge advantage to being non-legacy or new, if you will, versus being an existing carrier. I think we're all watching that very carefully and trying to figure it out. But boy, the step change in what happened in 15 to 20 was a loss that would have been $10 million in 2014 became $25 million immediately. And now $25 million may be $50 million, right? There's just this steep curve of valuation on losses. The social inflation is back and still charging forward, hence why the market needs to keep getting the rate that we're getting on the casualty side just to keep up with that pace.
And I suppose there's just more uncertainty than there has been for a long while when you have the effects of a pandemic, you have little inflationary spikes, and you don't know how much of it is a spike and how much is permanent and all the other stuff going on. Presumably, it's just harder to come up with a price.
Well, it's harder to know exactly where you stand in the price adequacy, if you will. Yes. I think the market has corrected to such a degree that we're debating about whether we're adequate, more than adequate, or way more than adequate. And so where you stand in that scaling is what the big debate is, and what will ultimately drive how much rate people are able to keep getting. Because we don't believe if we get 10%, say, on our casualty book, that we're increasing our margins. We're holding our margins because of how much trend is going on underneath.
And it's hard to explain that down, you know, to the broker and to that ultimate client. It doesn't feel like they're standing still to them, does it?
No. It goes to the nature of what you said a few moments ago. Is, boy, risk is changing quickly. Yeah, it is. And the idea that you can make a budget to buy a certain set of protections and that that's going to stay steady, it's just not realistic for a lot of the classes that we're in because the risk underneath is changing so much.
You mentioned earlier, right at the beginning, actually, about public D&O in the US. Again, it's one of these ones that seems difficult to understand. Certainly, it's perhaps the latest headlines, I think, from one of the major rating agencies would be that even in their opinion, it's really marginal. And if it goes down anymore, they'd be kind of down on it.
I'd say it's easy to understand in the macro sense. For a while, supply went down and demand went up in the form of IPOs and SPACs. And then supply started to come up to try and meet demand, and then demand went down. And so it doesn't take a economics Nobel Prize winner to understand, you know, supply and down, price down. But so
I don't know, as an observer, when, you know, when we're talking about a really advanced 21st century data-driven underwriters, but why can we be blindsided by a basic bit of supply and demand imbalance? You know, and why would we then knock 40% off our prices? It just seems very kind of last century.
And it was what I said earlier, you'd like to see the amplitude of those things come together because it went up a lot over 2 or 3 years and now it's come off. Yeah, you'd like to see that amplitude. I think that it is an incredibly important market and it's one that is closely watched and closely followed by, you know, there's no more important insurance purchase a CFO or treasurer can make with a D&O because every member of the board is closely watching and making sure it's enough, and then if not more so. And so it just gets a lot of spotlight on it. And so when things go wrong, there's a course correction. And then when things get good again, there's a course correction. And they just, the wave is very big. I love the team we have. I love what we're doing, but we're not a big player in that because we haven't seen the opportunity to really
go for it.
We think the return is adequate. We believe that. I agree with those statements, but we can't keep doing what we're doing for another.
Because it was such a big correction on the upside that giving a bit back is probably okay.
Yes, and a company's price for D&O at IPO is very, very heavy for good reason because so many things can go wrong. As that company ages and matures, the rate should come down and it should come down fairly meaningfully. So sometimes there's a little bit of that lost in the discussion around, you know, the rate change underneath may not be as big as it seems in the headlines, but it's certainly, look, we are of the view that right now it's adequate, but it just can't take another whatever double digit percent off again and still be able to say that.
Well, we'll keep all our eyes peeled for what's going on there. Something we've spoken about both the other times that you've been on the program is the great thing about being a new carrier is obviously no legacy on the financial side, but obviously no legacy on the technological side. I was just looking at your website before we started this interview, and I was really interested to see some of the things that you've been doing. I saw you had a tech-enabled construction surety product that was really interesting, automating, using data, AI, and everything else, and perhaps pushing some more sophisticated products that probably only very large companies used to be able to buy because they're buying it through big brokers and lots of bespoke work, and then trying to push some of those really bespoke, traditionally big company products into smaller and medium-sized enterprises. Anything else that you're doing? Obviously, that surety product certainly jumped out at me as being really interesting. Are you trying to do other things like that? And you've got a lot of hopes on that form of distribution.
Well, I'd say from the get-go, it was meant to be a tech-enabled company. In the early years, I regretted not saying it was an insurtech, although over the last couple of years, I'm glad we went with tech-enabled because it seems the multiples there are more normalizing between the two as we move forward in time. And we said we have a clean technology, so we're cloud-native. We rent the things, policy issuance, claims, general ledger that others have already built well. And then we build in-house around that. We call them studios. Some people call them workbenches, but the ability to harness together information that either we generate ourselves through our own analytical models or that we're able to harness from outside from others and bring that to the underwriter's desktop. And that was always the vision, and we continue to build towards that. Thank you for noting that one that you noted around.
I'm sure you've got loads more. It was just that's the one that jumped out.
Subselect, which is the idea of taking a subcontractor default product, which, yes, is generally sold from large to large to more middle market or smaller, is an example in using the technology to do something on distribution. We feel there is work that will give us great lift around operational efficiency, particularly as you get into AI and being able to take large amounts of information and synthesize them down to the critical facts to get that in front of the underwriter or decision maker. It could be anybody. We've built our Vantage GPT, if you will, inside our own firewalls and safe, and so people can go in and use that to explore. And then the third piece of it is, how do we go out and build analytical models to make better risk selection or risk evaluation decisions? And there we've done that. We've done some work around legal venues, assessing the riskiness of legal venues. We've done some work around commercial auto. We've done some work in the lawyers space as well, or lawyers E&O space. Each of those, because we're a new company, we had the advantage of being very nimble and lean and a really modern technology stack, but we don't have the historical data. What has become apparent over the last 5 to 10 years is that so much more data is available from the public domain. And so we were able to build each of those three models, almost entirely, a little bit of our own proprietary, but almost all built from publicly available data sets. And then our teams are using them and matching them up with exposure and building models. I think all that said, we're excited about where the opportunity is. There's a lot of discussion around AI and what AI is. And you know, AI can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But I think certainly this current wave of tools that have come online are going to let us just really radically change the way people operate and let the best talent get the best insights to make the best decisions. And that's what we're wired towards and built towards at Vantage. And we're excited about where that's going to take it. We're going to be super careful about it. No one here is allowed to say something or produce something right out of GPT and say it's done. They got to own the output. They got to own the outcome and make sure it makes sense and is rational. And we're going to be very careful around making sure we stay on the right side of not playing forward biases or other things that cause concern for ourselves and regulators, but we're excited about where this technology is going to take us.
Yeah, I suppose with this, most of the time, it's just having that willingness and that ability to experiment with it and to say, well, yeah, let's try it. There's plenty of other people out there who are just not actually even trying it. So you're way ahead.
But that was our first premise, which was let's get a safe, I don't want people going out to ChatGPT and our data's going out the door and all that. Let's get a safe version of that built in-house and everyone can experiment with it. And we've got about 40% of the people have experimented with it in the 6 months or so we've had it up and running. Our goal is to get that 40% way up. You know, I use the example of, think of any application, let's just name one, cyber. It's 60, 70, 80 pages of information. Do I want the underwriter, underwriting assistant reading all that and answering the questions that we think are critical? Or would I rather have it dumped in and run through a language recognition model and have it come out with, here's your answer to your questions. And by the way, here's the citation from where I found that answer so that we can go back and check it. Because again, I want to reiterate, we're not just taking this stuff out and, oh, it must be perfect. It's gone through a language recognition model.
It's amazing when you, particularly when you talk about what's publicly available. Of course, so for example, public D&O, of course, these are all public companies. They've all got their SEC filings. How many underwriters really can read 10,000 page annual reports with the notes to the accounts? And would they really have found all those different things? And if you could get a ChatGPT style assistant to say, hey, here are these five things in red that I think are a bit odd, but you're the underwriter, so you check it out. I mean, these kind of things would be pretty useful.
Oh, huge. Best insights, best decisions.
Because those, you can back test those against the actual claims activity because they're public companies, so the claims are public as well. So,
correct.
Yeah, you know, you can do a lot of testing. Again, that data is all there, isn't it? So,
it's not an answer, right? That's the key thing here for the areas that Vantage operates in. You know, you go back in time, I met many people that were called homeowners underwriters. You know, that's not really a thing anymore. Occasionally in the high value areas, companies will have underwriters because they're more complex risks that are, they're almost like commercial properties. And they used to have something called a personal auto underwriting department.
Yeah.
Even in the high end car market, I don't think that exists anymore. And in small commercial, it's less and less. I think those things all yield themselves to that because they are large numbers of smaller transactions. And that is actuarially credible. And that can yield itself to, you can trust the model more and what the output is. where we are, I am never going to say never, because boy, the pace of change from when I started in this business with a telex machine instead of a fax machine, instead of, you know, email now, you know, things change and are changing rapidly. I don't think, though, we're going to get to a spot where the public D&O market in the US with a few thousand risks, it's not credible enough. So what we're looking for is insights, not answers, insights. So the underwriter, the person, can then synthesize that and make the decision. That's what we're wired to do. And in our short conversations exhibited, you know, all the traits you would like, which is that native curiosity around, hey, wait a minute, if I think about this a little bit more, I can really do this. That's who we seek to hire.
Yes, obviously, yeah, you can offer me a job later. A good investigative journalist, we could even say that, you know, they're a pain in the ass, but they do ask some searching questions, don't they? Yes, the best ones. And I'm sure that's what a good assistant should be doing, asking difficult to answer questions or just putting things out there and making the underwriter better informed or forcing the underwriter to really think, which can only be a good thing.
Yep.
We're in a pretty good time for the markets, and markets are hitting historic highs all the time, every other day. And insurance stocks are being buoyed along with that tide, doing pretty well. So would now be a good time to seek a liquidity event?
If a generic company was fully built out, ready to go, and there are a number of those companies, some officially, some rumored to be out there, I think
and
it
some
is.
Some done very well and have had great IPOs and have roared on since.
And companies that have been in existence for a decade, right? A number of them. So look, in terms of vantage, we're very, very focused on, we're building the best company we can. We said when we started on this journey, it would be 5 to 7 years before we felt like, wow, we have built something and it's on plane or at scale, whichever phrase you want to use. And at that point, we'd look around and say, okay, what are the opportunities for us to monetize that success? But we're not driven by that. And we're not working towards a date to say, you know, everything we do must be ready by this date. We're very much motivated by, let's build the best vantage we can and the rest of it will take care of itself. Not least of which is you don't know where the markets will be when you are ready, right? So it's always a matter of you got to get yourself ready. You got to have a great business. You got to be able to tell the right story. And then you got to hit the market at the right time as well. And so for us, that's what we're completely focused on. And others are further along in their journey and can go ahead and hit this window. And we think that's great because it's more markers for kind of where we might be valued as we think about something.
But I suppose you've probably been able to go faster than you might have originally planned when you had your blank sheet of paper, you know, 4 years ago, because the market, I wouldn't want to put words in your mouth, but sitting here, it looks like the market's probably better than most people thought it would have been.
The wonderful thing about a business plan is it's your view of what you believe you can achieve over the course of time, given a certain set of realities. Some things have gone better. The property market is far better than it was when we launched this. Some things are not quite as good. The D&O market and cyber market, for instance, are giving back a little bit. Still adequate, but giving back. So you're not quite as strong. And then there's when you decide, as you said earlier, the advantage of starting out from scratch and building from new is you don't have any legacy issues. The downside is you're building from scratch. You're literally taking an idea on a piece of paper and bringing it to life. And we did that in, you know, we started that in late 2020, basically 2021. You know, it was hard to get some things done. It took us a full year to get our admitted and non-admitted carrier in the US signed, sealed, and delivered. And so there's this countervailing stuff. So I'd say we're on pace with where we wanted to be, maybe a little bit behind because of some of those operational realities, but very, very happy with what we've built and happy with the portfolio we have. And most importantly, happy with the direction we're headed over the next 3 years.
This is probably the last question, but it's more of an HR question. But I think this question also usually says a lot about the leadership of a business. So you be on your best behavior, Greg. Again, as a young company, it's great. Or being a startup company, you get that blank sheet of paper. I get to make the most idealized version of an insurance company and reinsurance company that I can, given my understanding and my resources today. We've had this pandemic has really changed working practices for all of us, you know, working from home, doing Zoom calls, Teams calls. It has changed things. I didn't use this technology much before. As a new, and I'm sure you pitch yourself as being, you know, the cutting edge of what is a progressive employer today, because you're such a new employee. You wouldn't design a regressive employer with sort of 19th century work practices when you only started a few years ago. So being very contemporary, what's your thinking around the work from home? And particularly now that the pandemic is really receding in our minds, what's your view on that? I mean, obviously, and that's why I said it does say a lot about the personality and perhaps in the style of each CEO, that some CEOs are very much, hey, I want everyone in the office, and that's becoming compulsory, or I want you at least 3 days in the office. What's your view on it, particularly as someone who's had the luxury of being a more idealistic business?
It's a great question, and one that we could do another 45 minutes on. We set up at a time when the pandemic was in full flight. So we started hiring people in late 2020, but most of them in 2021. There wasn't a lot of debate about what were we going to do. We were, by definition, going to be a virtual company. As I reflect on that time, there was a little bit of, if I could wave a magic wand, well, why wouldn't you say you'd put everybody in one or two, you'd have a location in Bermuda and a location in the US and have everybody be together and feel that energy and vibe as you built the company together? Just was not going to happen. So you have to get over yourself pretty quickly and step back and say, well, what are the trade-offs here? I have realized, both personally and I think as a leader, the ability of hybrid work to allow people to better balance work and life outweighs everything else. And it doesn't mean I'm advocating all virtual all the time. That's not what we're doing. We're doing hybrid. But we have over 100 of our 310 colleagues work more than 35 miles from any office space we might have. And we believe that it has a huge advantage. Just being able to hire the best people and wherever they've been, as others have asked for them to come back in. The trade-off is you've got to be very disciplined about communication and how you keep people informed. We have a all-hands call every Monday afternoon. We do a 15-minute random mix-up of people at Vantage, literally not drawn from a hat, but randomly assigned, and they spend 15 minutes together. We do 5 cups of coffee on a semi-regular basis, so just throw 6 or 8 people together and have a conversation. And then we're getting everybody live together for the second time in May. So you have to work really hard at communication to keep people connected and tight. And to acknowledge that, particularly as we hire some of our early career colleagues, we're not going to say you can work from wherever all the time. No, if you're in an underwriting team, you need to be near somebody. I don't have to have you necessarily all in the same place, but I need you near an office of a collection of people so you can see how we work, learn how we work, and be mentored. So that's a long-winded answer to a really super important question that we believe in hybrid. We're going to continue to use that, we think, as an advantage. We will get people together to make sure that mentorship needs to happen and that the greater good is that you're able to balance life and work better in that kind of environment than if you're trying to grind, to the office 5 days a week.
So it sounds really pragmatic rather than being idealistic. You don't have any kind of dogma about it.
And I don't think you can, because you're a young company. We're not a startup anymore. We're a young company. But it's 310 people. And boy, if you can't figure out how to be flexible in that environment, you're never going to be flexible. And I think that's the most important, is the facts and circumstances that come with people through their career journey from early career to seasoned executive brings with it a whole bunch of things that happen in life at the same time. And they require different flexibilities and different realities. And I think it's worth it. And you can see, the thing I always come back to is you can see productivity, whether you're virtual or in person. And so if maintaining productivity is one of the arguments for being all in the office, I think that's achievable in either environment.
And no, it seems like you need that flexibility. Certainly for some of those younger people, they wanted to come to the office. I remember during the pandemic, they missed going to the office because they had a proper desk. Because you forget, we're middle aged, we might have nice houses with lots of space. But some of these young graduates or, young school leavers, that they're sharing a very small apartment, probably in the nearer the center of a big city, and they haven't got any space. That kind of really basic stuff. And you think, oh, well, they're all kind of stepping on each other in the kitchen. And actually, they would love to get into an office with a nice environment where they got their own desk and also near to the people they can learn from. But other people are obviously completely different. And also people who are highly skilled, who could work incredibly effectively away from everyone else.
There are a couple of thoughts. I go to the office every day. I'm not away from home traveling somewhere. That's just the way I grew up doing it. That's the way I have my space. I think better. I've got some people around me. I get the energy from that as well. And that's just who I am. And I've tried to do some things from home, and I'm doing things this included, from a remote location is in the office, but by and large, I'm in the office. We have early career folks that fit a little bit of the model that you suggest, right? Which is, I'm in a small space, I'm gonna get out. But we also have folks that, I'll make it up anonymous, so I don't call anybody out, nobody recognizes exactly what I'm talking about, but they play the violin. And the only way they can play the violin with the group of people that is of the caliber and talent that they have is at 4 o'clock on Thursday and Friday afternoon. Why would I not give them the flexibility to go do that? Because the trade is they are happier, they're better motivated, and they are just as likely to be on at 6 a.m. working on something as they are at 4 p.m. working on something, because we've given them the tools to do that. That to me is the trade-off that we make, that we think we get really motivated people to do that. with the full acknowledgement, pragmatic may be a word, Mark, that you used a few moments ago, but I think it's also kind of trying to optimize the hybrid reality, is that you still need to be together at critical times. And I would say the most critical time that people have to get in the same room is when you're trying to, you could use the word argue, you could use the word debate, you could use the phrase problem solve. When you're getting into really meaty stuff that involves people from multiple areas, in the room works way better than on the screen. And so we've encouraged our folks, when you're building something in a project, or when you're trying to tackle which new market do I go into, get in the room and do that, because that is a real lift. And so hence why we have the hybrid approach. You need both.
And you have those company-wide in-person events as well, which you'd say they're really important, right?
They're really important. This will be our second one, so it's kind of working to every 18 months or so. They're super important. It gives everybody a medium to meet others that they know of, but don't necessarily work with day in and day out. And then almost as importantly to the main event is before and after folks are getting their groups together to do some of what I talked about in terms of problem solving. So we're excited about that coming up in May.
And if they haven't met you in person, Greg, they can always listen to the podcast.
And I give them, we'll repeat it a few times, and no matter who I'm talking to, come interrupt me and introduce yourself, because the only way I'm going to meet all of you is if you do that. So that's the standing rule, is there's no such thing as a closed conversation. Just come on in and
don't be shy.
Don't be shy. Yeah.
Well, Greg, you've been far from shy. I've really enjoyed talking to you, as I always do. Keep on motoring along and riding the plane while you can. And obviously, we'll book you in for another meeting. It'd be nice to do it face-to-face at some point. So I need to get over and cross the Atlantic with the podcast, I think, sometime soon. So if that happens, I'd love to be sitting in the room opposite rather than sitting in a chat room somewhere, as we are now.
Love to have you. Would love to see you. Happy to do it. Thanks so much for having me on and taking the time to chat.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, don't forget to subscribe or leave a like or a review or recommendation on whatever podcast platform you used to access this program. These really help get the word out. Before we go, just a quick reminder that advertising slots are available here and in other places in the Voice of Insurance podcasts. Podcasting is the fastest growing medium and attracts a high quality audience of key decision makers. It's also an intimate medium where you, the listener, are right in the room with me and the interview subjects. Needless to say, that means it's a great way of getting your message out directly to an audience, because you know you've got their full attention. It's also very cost effective. So get in touch with Mark at thevoiceofinsurance.com to find out how you could be speaking directly to the industry. The Voice of Insurance podcast is produced in association with Advantage Go, enabling enterprise-scale underwriting through a single pane of glass. Voice of Insurance is produced by me, Mark Gagan. Music was written by Anna Gagan and produced by Carlos Gagan. Check out more podcasts and written comment pieces at www.thevoiceofinsurance.com.